Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming to our panel. My name is Taryn Berger, and my career in comics is pretty much due to this man sitting on my left. This is pretty much, you hired me, this is Paul Levitz, legendary writer, editor, former president, publisher of DC Comics, also a teacher, spokesperson for the comic book industry worldwide. And Paul, this is going to be a spotlight on Paul, obviously that's why you guys are here. And Paul hired me, if you can believe this, 38 years ago, October 1st. God. So I started October 1st, 1979. So this is pretty crazy, really crazy. I was 21, you were 23, I think? 22 and a half or something
yeah,
like that?
I'm about a year older.
Almost 23. And he was pretty much running the company. Paul was sort of a wunderchild, as we like to call him. You know, my career in many ways really, you know, goes back to Paul over here. We've been friends and colleagues for many years. Paul was my boss for 31 years, I think, 32 years, something like that. I think I was there a year and a half after you left staff. I learned so much from Paul. Paul was a real mentor to me. He drove me crazy sometimes, and I drove him crazy sometimes. But I think we had a lot in common. We both grew up in Brooklyn. Different neighborhoods, went to different schools. But I think there's something about growing up in Brooklyn at a certain time in your life that there's kind of a kindred spirit. So I think we always connected in that way. And, you know, I was really honored that Paul asked me if I would interview him for this panel. So one of the things that I wanted to start off with is that, you know, as I mentioned, Paul has done so many things in the comic book industry. And I remember that probably around 10 years ago, Paul went to Stuyvesant High School, which is a very prestigious public high school in New York City. And they had their 100th anniversary, and Paul was one of the graduates who's being honored at the event. And Paul invited, you know, several people from the office there. It was a huge gala. And Frank McCourt, the famous author who wrote Amber's Ashes and Tis, was Paul's high school teacher at Stuyvesant. And Paul was Frank McCourt was the host of the event. But not only was Paul one of the people who was honored, there were a couple of Nobel Prize physicists who were honored. I think it was Chris Albrecht,
Richard Axel, and me.
Right, yeah. It was a very prestigious crowd. And in the brochure to the event, there was a bio, you know, I guess the honorees each wrote their own bio. And I was always struck, and I don't think I ever mentioned this to you, Paul. Paul, with everything that Paul had done in comics as a publisher and president, and so much he had done at DC as a person who led the company for so many years and led the comic book industry for so many years, his first line was, "Paul Levitz is a writer and is best known for his work on Legion of Superheroes." And it was almost like your day job was the afterthought. And I was always struck by that. And I guess I always wanted to ask you, did you always want to be a writer? Or, I mean, clearly you were always a comics fan. But tell us about how did you, you know, get into comics as a kid? And
okay, well, let me answer the literal question first and segue from that to the broader one. The writer was listed first because creative work outlasts business work. I mean, in people's minds, the majority of you who are in this room, I would bet, are more likely to be here because you read something that I wrote when you were 12 or 16 years old that made an impression on you and that you cared about. And some of the work that I did as a business guy perhaps is more important to the fact that we can can have 150,000 people in this building and all the diversity of happening, and hopefully we'll talk a little bit about some of those things too. But I know that the creativity is what matters emotionally to people. It's the same thing that Julie Schwartz was one of the great editors who, of the generation that preceded mine. He knew I was a science fiction fan, and periodically, when I was a punk assistant editor, would yell down the hall, "Paul, come down here." I didn't work for Julie. There was no useful business from that call, but, you know, it was, "Say hi to Ike, Dr. Asimov." And I'm melting on the floor. I don't remember saying anything else coherent there. Hopefully I said something about how many of his 300-odd books I had read and how much I admired the man's work. But I know that feeling. So I have a pride in the writer part of me because of the meaning it has to the people around me. The business part I have a great deal of pride in because of what it accomplished for the field and for people I care about. But I know it doesn't matter to as many people as much, so it slides down a little bit. I didn't expect to ever write fiction. A couple of years before I got into the comic business as a very, very young person, I tried writing a story and couldn't get past about page two. I came into comics when Joe Orlando stopped me and called me in from the hall one day while I was working on my fan magazine, The Comic Reader, sort of a TV guide for the field. He said, "You come in here. You know, I need somebody to write my letter columns. You want to write my letter columns?" I'm not a writer, Joe. "I read your fanzine. You write well enough to write a letter column." Okay, I was 16. I didn't realize that was probably as low a bar as you could possibly be asked to pass. But there I was, suddenly 16, and I was a professional writer, signing $15 a page. When Joe's assistant, Michael Fleischer, took off that summer, he asked me to fill in. So I was suddenly an assistant editor at 16. Michael never came back. He lived a happy life. I didn't kill him, Shelley, I swear. He went off to freelance writing, things like that. And I never left.
And you were junior in high school then?
No. I came on staff the day after I graduated high school.
Okay. So okay.
I was just a very young high school graduate. You must have been SP also.
And, well, I skipped third grade.
Yeah. New York skipped people prodigiously
in those years. And maybe SP, but my mom didn't let you do it. Skip again because I'd be too young.
Yeah. You would have missed 2 years. Yeah. So I missed the eighth grade, not the third, but I was a little slower than Karen.
At that age, he made up for it, though.
So working on rewriting other people's scripts, editing people's scripts, I said, "Hey, you know, this isn't that complicated. I think I can figure out how to do this." And in fact, the standards for writing things like short stories for House of Mystery were not extraordinarily high in those years. So I was able to figure it and sort of slowly grew into a bit of a writer. It took quite a few years after that for me to write anything that people remembered fondly. But by the time Karen showed up and we worked together on Legion, I had hit my stride, and that's the stuff people remember me for most.
So how did you balance being a writer, being an executive of the company? How did you balance those two aspects of your life from a time perspective, and just from a, you know, headspace? I mean, how did you clearly had talents as a business person and as a creative person, and what did you choose to go down the company path as opposed to becoming a full time freelance writer? Because at that point you were working on Legion and Stalker. You were doing a lot of stuff. I didn't realize how much stuff you wrote until I looked on Wikipedia to brush up.
It's almost 500 stories.
Yes, yeah. I had no idea.
There was a period probably for about 5 or 6 years in the 80s when I could have made more money as a freelance writer than I was making on staff. I had a lot of responsibility, but because I had grown up inside the company, when you grow up inside an organization, you're usually not paid as well as the person who would be hired for that job from the outside would have gotten. It takes a while for them to say, you deserve what we would pay a stranger. I think Karen suffered that at points in her career as well, and I apologize for my part in that.
But he eventually made up for it. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been true for a lot of us.
Especially when you start very young at a company.
For the most part, I did most of my freelance writing on weekends. I managed not to bring too much of the office work home for weekends. So that was kind of segregated, and at least until my kids came along, it was the second job you worked in either late at night after everybody else was asleep, or quietly in the weekend when somebody else might be out shopping in it. The headspace was more complicated, both because the jobs were somewhat in conflict from time to time. I didn't think a lot, because I really felt I'm a believer in what's called stakeholder theory, where I think a corporation has a responsibility not only to its owners, but to its customers, its suppliers. In the case of comics, that's the creators, the creative talent, the retailers, the distributors. The company is only healthy if everybody who's connected to it is healthy. Some things are a zero-sum game, but most things are not. Most things we benefit together more than separately. So I never felt that was enormously in conflict. But occasionally it was a little bit weird. There were things I couldn't compete for. You may remember after Crisis on Infinite Earths, we were going to do another one of these big crisis events. I mean, this was very rare in those years. And we had an open call for the writers to submit their ideas for what the next one was. And I thought it would be a fun kind of thing to do. First comic I remember buying was Crisis on Earth 1, way back in the 60s. So I submitted something called Crisis of the Soul, in which Green Arrow would go evil. I figured we could screw with him. He wasn't that serious a character in the mythology at that point. But I submitted it without my name on it, so that it wouldn't prejudice on it. And you were the only one who spotted it.
Really? I have no memory of this.
Yeah. Nobody else figured out whose it was, and you came down the hall and says, "This one's yours, isn't it, Paul?"
I remember the title, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think Jerry Ordway was going to draw it. Jerry did some rough art for it at the time. Never went anywhere. But
that's great.
You had a good eye.
Yeah. Could tell a writer hiding behind his style, I guess, right? Yeah. Or trying to at least. Well, that's funny. See what you learn when you do a panel after knowing someone for 38 years. Now, you were obviously so young, in charge of so many things at DC. When I came in, Saul Harrison was the president of the company, Jeanette Kahn was the publisher. I mean, they clearly were the grown-ups. And Paul was and then it was Julie Schwartz. It was Julie Schwartz and
Joe Orlando,
obviously. So we did have other adults around. But then there was the other generation of, like, Len Wein and Jack Harris and with the other editors and you and a bunch of assistants like Lois Sutton and me. And I think that's about it. And when I came into D.C., there were only 35 people there.
Right.
And when I left in whatever year that was, they had cut back. But at one point, I think
about
it was 350. What, about 300?
We hit just about 300.
In your heyday, yeah. But when you were, like, really young and you had to deal with different departments when we were still part of Warner Communications, because in the early days, when DC was acquired by Steve Ross and the Warner Communications family, we were under the publishing division, and it wasn't until the first Batman movie, 89, was when Warner Brothers said, "Hey, we want them," right? And then we went over to them. But in those early days of when we were part of Warner Publishing, here you were, like, as you said, this punk kid, in your early 20s, sitting at meetings with people, twice your age. How did you, did you feel, well, I don't think you were ever intimidated by anybody. Because knowing this man, Paul, one of the things I liked about him, and one of the things I didn't like about him, was he told you exactly how he felt. And I think as Paul got older, he was a little bit more diplomatic. But when you were younger, there were times when he would just tell you, nah, I really don't like that, you know, and then just walk away. Oh, so, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I probably would have... The adult me probably would have shot the 20-year-old and given half a chance.
Paul was, you know, he was... you'd always get a straight answer out of him. But he, you know, patience wasn't his biggest virtue as a young man. I don't think mine was either, so I think we shared that common trait. And I think we both sort of had a temper, but we, as a common trait, though, again, disguised it, were quick to temper, I guess. But how did you, like, did you get pushback from people? I mean, do you have any stories or memories when someone was like, who is this kid? And
It was a totally weird thing in some ways. I mean, I basically got broad responsibilities because they did, at age 24, they didn't think it was worth bringing in anyone from the outside as a senior business person for the company. Jeanette Kahn was just named president. Saul was retiring. And I got to inherit a lot of what Saul had done. And I guess the job became what in modern terms you'd call chief operating officer for DC. But my title was just manager of business affairs because they didn't want to give the little kid a serious title. But nonetheless, I was there with Jeanette at corporate budget meetings with Steve Ross and the most senior multi-million
Manny
dollar executive.
Was that before the
Manny Girard, J.M. and real business heavyweights with enormously more worldly experience than I had.
Well, they were also like 25, 30 years older than you, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you don't have a 24-year-old kid coming in a room. I mean, running a company or practically running a company at that age.
I mean, it wasn't a company anyone took too seriously, so...
It was just a comic book company.
Right? You know, this story has been told to me many times by people who worked at the company one floor away, the distribution company, that they would give advice to the young people... Don't get out on 6. That's where the weird people are. Perhaps they met some of us.
Yeah.
Occasionally, it was weird. I suddenly was the boss of people my father's age.
Right.
Arthur Gutowitz, Milt Snappin, names that there's no reason you guys would know, but our controller. And our controller, on one occasion, I remember vividly turning around saying, you can't say that you're going to have the publishing business profitable next year. If you do that, they'll expect you to do it every year. Arthur, that's the idea. That's what we're supposed to do. It was challenging, even challenging back when I was an editor. I mean, one of the most challenging moments for that was editing the Batman books, and Bob Haney was writing Brave and Bold. And Bob was, in many ways, a wonderfully talented writer. He'd been literally writing Brave and Bold since about when I was born, and yet he couldn't get used to this idea of making things connect with any other title. His version of Batman was his version of Batman, and it just didn't need to match anything else. And I didn't think that was the right way to do Batman. So after working with him for a few issues like that and talking to him and trying to get him to do it, I finally had to turn around and basically fire this guy off the assignment who'd been writing this thing since I was born.
I think it was, so what year was it? I think I remember
It's probably right about when you got there. And that was insanely hard. That may be have been one of the hardest days I ever had working. And I guess I was 22 or 23 at the time. And we stayed talking to each other. He wrote other stuff for me for other books afterwards, but he certainly never forgave me and certainly never believed that what I was doing was the right and intelligent thing to do. And there's a case to be made for his point of view on that. But I think those things were always tough. I don't know that I never get intimidated or that I certainly got intimidated by Isaac Asimov that day. But I don't get intimidated easily in a business situation.
Right.
So that helped me a lot. And I was an arrogant little puppy. That probably
he was.
Probably should have been smacked around a few times.
That's okay. It got him far.
So. You know,
but he was nice to people. He really was nice, and you know, you could have had your moments where you pissed people off, but you know, Paul always had the interest of others at heart, and is extremely generous in terms of your time, in terms of your advice, and especially when it comes to came to writers and artists. I mean, Paul taught me, and Joe Orlando taught me, and Dick Giordano taught me that, you know, writers and artists, they come first. You know, we're just here to help them sort of get their stories done, but you have to have respect for them. You have to, you know, make sure they have all the tools that they need to get the job done. And, you know, never think that they're working for you. You know, I mean, it's in many ways you're working for them. And that was something that was instilled in me, you know, by Paul, Joe, and Dick. And it's something that all editors should remember, because it's, you know, it's all how all this stuff gets done. And a good editor knows how to wrangle their talent, and I think you did that pretty well. Though I don't know if Bob Paney would agree.
Bob probably wouldn't, but I mean, a lot of the writers I work with, Len, Marv, Denny, have said kind things in the years since.
As an editor, what are the books that you worked on that you're most proud of?
You know, I think the Batman books are the stuff that survives. They just reprinted.
Is that Denny's stuff that you...
All the guys. I mean, I had...
How many years did you edit Batman?
I did the Batman books for about 3 years. And Detective 500 probably is the single issue I stand by. I knew I was giving up editing at that point, and I really threw everything but the kitchen sink into that one.
That was a big deal, I remember that, because that was like a big oversized issue.
Yeah.
It was a bit more oversized than other annuals or big events. And I remember, because that was pretty early on in my career there, and I remember that being a really big deal.
And the other editorial thing that I'm really proud of is the 9/11 benefit book that we did many years later.
Yeah,
because I hadn't,
amazing book.
I hadn't been editing for 20 years.
Thank you.
And, you know, in many ways it was a dream assignment for an editor. I mean, forget the horror of why it was happening. But here was a project that literally the greatest writers and artists were sitting there saying, happy to do this, just tell me what you need, can I get in on this? And I don't need any money, because take my money and give it to the cause. So I got to edit Stan Lee and Michael Moorcock. What the fuck? And really just an amazing group of people in that. And one moment during that, Mo Willems, the Sheep in the Big City guy, was starting to write a few comics at that point. He hadn't done much in the way of comics, he'd never drawn one, but he wanted to write and draw a short story for that issue. And he came in with the rough layouts for the story. It was a little 6-page thing about walking the Brooklyn Bridge, I think. And I worked him over pretty roughly, showing him you could do this better, you could do that. Pieces of the craft. I'm not a great art editor. I'm a writer's editor more than anything else, but Joe Orlando taught me a lot when I was his assistant, a certain number of sort of art for the art blind tools to work with. And Mo was terrific. He sucked it all in and said, yeah, you know, argue with something if he didn't agree with it, but he got a lot out of it and went out very happily and peacefully. And when he left, I sat back and said, wow, I couldn't have done that when I was editing as a kid. I didn't know how. This must be what it felt like to be Joe Orlando. And then I thought for another second and said, shit, I'm the age Joe was when I was working for him. And it was one of those most vivid moments when you realize that you can't hurry some kinds of learning.
Yeah.
So when I look back at the editing I did, I was a line editor from 19 to 24, basically. Most of it, I look back and say, it's really not bad for how young and stupid I was. And for the times we were in. But a little of the Batman stuff holds up, and people look at it happily. The Untold Legend stories.
Yeah. A lot of great ones.
The idea of Catwoman and Batman having a romance, which was not in the comics in any serious fashion before that.
Right.
And
yeah,
we got it. Those first tales were from issues that I presided over. And a lot of the artists and writers that I worked with. Mark Chiarello, who was DC's cover editor for many years, at one point started to give me shit about the, you know, the crappy kinds of guys you used to use for covers in the old days. And I went home that night, checked my editorial records and made the list of everybody I had used and how many covers they had done, and came back and showed Mark, you know, the number of Kalutas, the number of Q-Birds, the number of Aparos, and yeah, I'll cop to there were two or three Louis Dominguez, but nice man, just not the best cover artist. But the list was such a Mark just said, oh, all right. But I got to work with just an amazing group of people in those years.
Now, as a writer, which writers were you most influenced by as a younger writer, and as an older writer, because that's the next era I wanted to talk about, since Paul left D.C., one of the many things that he's doing, even though Paul has one of the things that Paul would always like to say, that I'm a lazy son of a bitch, right? You have said that many times.
I have.
I'm a lazy son of a bitch, but this lazy son of a bitch leaves working at a company after decades, is a consultant still to Warner Brothers, teaches three college-level courses, writes, you know, this, you know, mega, the big Tosh and 75th anniversary of DC Comics, a wonderful biography about Will Eisner, while you're also writing a couple of series for DC. And, you know, so clearly you might be lazy, but you're a lazy person who likes to be have a lot going on or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I write very quickly. I'm one of the...
He does everything really quickly. When I still remember my first interview at DC was pretty quick. We sort of, you know, went over, talked for like 15 minutes, Paul asked me a few questions, and then he took me on a tour of the office. And I had to like run to catch up with him because Paul was just like such a fast walker and whatever, but yes. And he's a speed reader as well, too. He'll give me something to read, something you might have been, I might say, been laboring, something I've been... was writing, you know, say a presentation or a proposal or a publishing plan. I would labor over something maybe for, you know, for hours writing something. And I'd give it to Paul. He'd speed read it. He'd take a pen. He'd go bark, 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 and then throw it back at me. And he says, just do this, this, this. And he was always right. You know, you always were. No, on that stuff you were. Creatively, I might give you a hard time. But when it came to sheer structure and what's important, and this is your lead, and you should get into this first, and nobody gives a shit about that. I mean, again, that going back to Paul's directness, you know, your ability to, like, you know, almost like take a picture of something in your head and be able to organize it and then spit it back out in a very accessible fashion was always something I always drove me crazy about you, but something I always admired about you. As well.
I'm good at the nonfiction stuff,
yes.
Certainly.
Yes.
That's served me well. And I do read very fast and write very fast. I don't know that I do everything very fast, but I like to keep busy. I mean, I do perversely kind of think of myself as an underachiever.
Hey, you've always said that about yourself.
No, I don't.
So, if this is an underachiever, what would the overachiever or just a regular achiever have accomplished in your life? So,
I might have finished college. I don't know. I don't really know. I mean, I'm very proud of what I've done. And I don't mean
and you
to put
should
it down
be.
In any fashion. I think the reason I describe myself as lazy is I do look for the simple way to do things. I mean, a lot of what helped me in organizational stuff was trying to find the most efficient, effective way of getting things done. That would be the easiest, that would consume the least energy. And I think I got to be very good at that over the years. The writers who influenced me, flipping back to that
sure,
side,
yes.
On the comic stuff, I think my style was mostly influenced by Stan Lee by way of Roy Thomas. Roy's Avengers was the very specific kind of model that I deconstructed when I started writing group superhero comics with Justice Society and Legion. My own style is my own style. It's not their fault, but it was more influenced by their work than anyone else. Jerry Conway, certainly, serving as his assistant editor for a couple of years when he was at DC. Denny O'Neill editing me early on. You editing me later. Joe enormously in my youth. Reading writers, science fiction side, Asimov very heavily early on, Roger Zelazny,
right, yes.
I really bonded with our mutual friend Mr. Gaiman off that early on. Damn him, he can write like Zelazny, I cannot. But we both enjoyed that same sort of style of work. Mystery side, Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Ed McBain, whose work is no longer as often in print, but very much is a terrific model for the kind of serial storytelling that we do in comics. An awful lot to learn from.
And you're also a real history buff, too, I remember early on, telling about Robert Moses and...
I read a lot of history, a lot of nonfiction. I don't read a lot of literary fiction very often. You would occasionally throw me books I remember fondly. You're throwing me Junot Diaz's big book, and years later getting to be a friend of his. Which I would never have been able to say, I read and enjoyed your book if Karen hadn't thrown it at me.
Right, that's a brief, wondrous life, I think.
Karen has much better taste in literature than I do. Much more highfalutin taste, anyway.
Someone has to, I guess. just a couple of other sort of quick things I wanted to ask you in terms of your own writing. I mean, currently you're writing for Dark Horse. You're doing the Brooklyn Blood series, which is
just wrapped up.
Just wrapped up in Dark Horse Presents, and that is that collected yet? It will be collected into.
Will be collected. It's basically one graphic novel's worth of material spread out over a very long time. And starting another project for Mike.
Oh, you are? Great.
Little mini-series. A rabbi, a priest, and a minister walk into a bar. Except they're dead, and they're there to find out what their unfinished business is.
That sounds great. Kind of sounds like something I'd be interested in.
We're
going to have to get around to doing that one of these.
Yeah, we have to do something.
After all this time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we did do Legion.
Yeah, but it's time. It's time for another round.
Time. Yeah, you never pitched me anything at Vertigo. I guess you couldn't then because you were running the company. That would be weird.
Well, I mean, that comes back to, I guess, your earlier question.
Especially if you didn't approve it, so. Anyway.
Well, no, I mean, I think it was back to your earlier question about the conflict between the two roles. I mean, I really felt once I got some kind of stripes that I couldn't compete for writing assignments with the other writers. Once I was a vice president of the company, it was just outrageous for me to do that. So I was okay about still writing Legion because I'd been writing that. It was successful. It was good for the company. I didn't feel like I was taking anything away from anybody else. But anything else, it just felt wrong. So, I mean, I did one or two other things, like Marv needed to go on vacation from Teen Titans because of some stresses in his life, so I filled in for a few issues. But I did that as staff work.
Right.
I didn't take a paycheck for it. Because I did feel that was a conflict by that time. It would have been weird to pitch a series to you in all those years. I also don't know that my natural skill set matched what you were doing in Vertigo. I mean, I had such enormous respect for the creative tonality of Vertigo. I used to describe Karen's responsibilities there as doing books that made me uncomfortable.
Yes.
She was very good at that. But
that was going to be one of my next questions. But yes, But it's like, ultimately, it was your responsibility at the end of the day with this stuff going out there. And you gave me a lot of rope. You gave me a lot of rope, and I might have hung myself once or twice, but not really. I mean, you really gave me the autonomy and the freedom, which I'm, eternally grateful for. Seriously, because I would not have been able to do the stuff that I was doing if I didn't have the support of Paul and before Paul Jeanette. Because you have to remember, this was DC Comics. This is, Mom and Apple Pie, and here we are going into a whole different way of comic storytelling and growing up in medium. And, in those early days, it was a big deal. It was a big deal to curse in a comic. It was a big deal to show sexual situations. It was a big deal to talk about certain issues. And it's second nature now, to tend to the audience that you're writing for. But you know, 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, it was a big deal. We really changed
the limits of the business.
Exactly, exactly. And again, that was a big responsibility as a publisher that you took on. And why did you do that, Mr. Levitz?
Well, and Jeanette and I both believed in different ways that comics could be more than they were. When she arrived at DC a couple of years after I was there, she was a real breath of fresh air and certainly prepared to take on the world and change things in some fashion or another. She didn't really have the full authority to do it in her first few years, and it wasn't clear what the opportunities were at the beginning. But by the time the newsstand was clearly dying and the direct market was going to be the next stage of the comic book business, it was obvious to us that the audience in the comic shops was going to be a little bit older, a little bit more sophisticated. They could be entertained in a more sophisticated way than writing the stories for kids that had traditionally been DC's business. That wasn't an easy transition to make. There was nobody in comics doing truly sophisticated material in those years. Not writers, not publishing companies. There were a few.
Epic for a short period of time. Archie, Epic.
A couple of, still the same time, that's the same period when we start trying to do
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
I mean, they might have been offering a better deal than we let you offer in those couple of years.
Yeah.
But, you know, you go to 1981, when we've instituted royalties, Jeanette's become president, I'm working the business side, trying to grow the direct market, trying to funnel money into the distribution and retail sides of the business so that we can get more comic shops, we can get a healthier business, improve the formats, improve production values, improve the working conditions of the creative people. We believed there was something more. We didn't know what the hell it was. I mean, an enormous percentage of the material that's on sale downstairs that is creatively diverse and wonderful would have been absolutely unimaginable to me. And much of it is not a flavor that I enjoy as a reader. But I rejoice in the diversity of it and what's happening.
That's amazing. It really is.
And that's what's fueled all of this growth. We would not be a billion-dollar business if we were just producing the same two or three flavors of ice cream. And it's changed the lives of the creative people. Not all of them. It's still a tough world to be a creator in. But many of them have done better than they ever possibly could have in the old systems. But it wasn't up to us to discover what that was. One of the reasons I never took the editor-in-chief title or a senior editorial title, period, was I believed that we were best served by having strong editorial leaders for the different imprints. My job as publisher was to draw the boundaries of the sandbox that we were willing to do, that what was acceptable to our owners, because not everything was acceptable to our owners, what was quote-unquote responsible publishing, however you want to define that. And we had our occasional issues about what that was. But within those boundaries...
That's something. I mean, you need to have that in a creative media. You know,
and I don't think I was right all the time, but you are making in those situations the best decision you can on limited information and in limited periods of time. And we'd fight it out. Sometimes the answer would be, okay, I trust you. Sometimes it would be, I think you're crazy, but I don't think it's too dangerous.
A lot of times it was that. Right, yeah.
Go ahead. Sometimes it would be, I just don't think this is the right thing for us to do, and we just, I'm not going to let you proceed with it. That wasn't...
It didn't happen too often.
You know, it's a handful of times that I can remember over all the years. Because you were very focused on what you were doing and what you were building, and you understood the idea that there were boundaries and limits. You wanted to push them and stretch them. But
and
most
do it
of,
for a reason.
Yeah.
Not gratuitously, within context. Right.
Most of the time you would come in first and argue, I need to push the wall here and move it out. We need, you know, your famous argument about using the word fuck in the comics.
Right.
I had Karen up at a course I teach at Columbia this spring for the reverse version of this.
Exactly. Yeah.
And she was cheerfully telling the story of how, you know, she knew she had to get the word fuck in the Vertigo comics, and I just was against it. So she went around me to Jeanette and convinced Jeanette.
Oh, but that was very easy. I didn't have to convince her. She was, of course, sure.
And, you know, she came and let me know, and I just sort of sighed. I wish you wouldn't have done that.
Did you really have to do that?
But, you know, that was the dynamic of the place. We were all very much working for the same set of goals. We didn't always know where we were going. But we knew what we were building towards as a compass point. We were building towards the idea comics should handle many kinds of material. Creators, writers, and artists should be able to prosper with their work. They should do well when the company does well. The company should be good at supporting the work of creative people. The retailers, the distributors should be able to do well when we're doing well. Our owners will be fine. You know, we have to mail them money every year. That's fine. We have to respect some of their wishes. But we're building something. We're building something for an industry that we think can be more. The work on building the world of the graphic novel. You know, for me, that was a passion thing when I came into Authority. If you went into a bookstore, you could get Agatha Christie, not just John Grisham. If you went into a record store, you could get Mozart, you could get Beatles. If you went into a comic shop, you could get a dusty old overpriced copy of an old Superman comic, or you could get this month's issue. That's not right. Well, the first two ways I tried to solve it as a business guy failed miserably. We tried an album format thing that we licensed out to Roger Slifer for a beautiful reprint of Archie Goodwin and Walt Simonson's Manhunter, one of the best comics we'd done to that time. Format didn't work in the comic shops, went nowhere. We tried a series of offset reprints of things like New Gods and Dead Man. You know, they sold enough to make some money, but they didn't manage to stay in print. We couldn't figure it out. It wasn't until the trade paperback idea, when Dark Knight Returns, that we found a form that worked.
But I think it was also because the audience had also gotten older for comics at that time, too. And the book form, many people just wanted to read a story in book form. They didn't want to maybe, you know, go, or they didn't have the time, they were older, they didn't go into a comic book store every week. And they really, you know, wanted to wait for the, to read as a book. But also, you know, to your point, I mean, putting the comics in book form was what also helped break us out of the superhero genre only aspect of comics. We were able to get people, get the books at bookstores and really expand the reach.
Well, and even besides the bookstores, it created conversion. I mean, with Neil on Sandman was the incredibly powerful tool for that. It was Sandman, Dark Knight, Watchmen. Not to say there weren't things from other companies that had effect on that too, but DC had the economic resources to do things that most of the other publishers couldn't, and the willpower to do things that Marvel wasn't interested or willing to do. And we were really able to build the form that way. Sandman converted so many people who we hadn't seen before, so many women that we hadn't seen before.
Yes.
And it wasn't, I think, that you sat there and said, let's do this book for the girls. It was that you wanted something that was more interesting, more sophisticated, more challenging. You saw in Neil a writer you could challenge to do more and to do more. He was amazing. You had to have synchronicity of these things. We had to have...
So much of it is that. I mean, and that's, you know, when things happen organically, is, you know, it's that's when the big things really happen. I think creatively, in any art form, it just happens to happen when things are sort of calculated too much. Most of the times, it's not as good.
Yeah, and a lot of it, you create the potential for the synchronicity to happen by putting together the parts. An editor who wants to challenge the limits of the form. In Jeanette, a leader of the company who was prepared to take the risks of things and not take the easy way out, work for the long run in the process. I was really good through the 80s, I think, in building systems.
Mm-hmm.
This is,
excellent.
You know,
that's
seeing awesome. Where the business and the industry was likely to go. This is the pressure point. In order to do this, we have to get our distributors to do this. We have to incentivize our retailers to do this. We have to create opportunities for the talent this way. We need to have Vertigo as a separate part of the company, because Karen was doing a wonderful job at one point in her career editing traditional superheroes, or relatively traditional superheroes, like Legion and Wonder Woman. An awful lot of the Wonder Woman movies success
run, yeah,
is
from
material
George's
that was
run.
Done in your
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you do the traditional stuff 2 hours a day, and then you do the incredibly weird stuff for the next 4 hours a day. And that, talk about schizophrenic, that was an incredibly schizophrenic process. And we just turned around at one point and said, if for this to work, we really have to keep you from being schizzy. And really, if Vertigo's going to work, well, maybe the rates have to be different. Maybe it's more of a writer's medium than an artist's medium over here. Let's weight it a little more that way.
And I think what, again, for a lot of people in the room here, again, this is very commonplace. Creator material and creator-driven comics now, but again, we were doing this stuff right at the beginning and starting it off, for the most part, with some other publishers, but in terms of having the resources at DC Comics that we have financially, because we're owned by Warner Brothers, you know, helped us, and having Paul's, you know, really Paul and Jeanette's vision for the company to see comics in a bigger way. And I think we're running out of time, but if there's one thing that you, I guess, are most proud of in everything that you've done professionally, what would it be?
On the business side, it's the changes I helped make common in the creators' lives. I wrote the first standard contract for creators in 77.
Right.
The royalty plan that I helped figure out how to do and how to make effective, that changed the economic rewards for the field. It's a hard tie between that and the stuff I did in helping the graphic novel form come to life, because the graphic novel is now the largest part of the comic book business and growing at a wonderfully healthy rate. And looks to be really the heart of the business for the next 20 years. I hope the periodicals will continue around as a form. I love writing. I love writing the Perils of Pauline kind of continued story. But those two things, I think, are kind of tied as the answer in the process. It's a hell of a lot of fun. Beat the hell out of any kind of honest work.
Well, I will say that I owe this man a lot more than I could ever really say. So,
so you might sign off on a proposal if I pitch you a series?
Maybe. Actually, Mike says, and wouldn't it be great if you actually edit a ball? So, but seriously, you know, Paul has done so much for the industry in so many ways, and I will say, and personally, I know my life would be a hell of a lot differently if you weren't a part of it. So thank you for hiring me almost 38 years ago.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for making me look good.
Anyway, so thank you, everybody. Thank you, guys.